Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, I'm Mike Williams. Welcome to One Planet from the BBC. I'm in London today, on the south bank of the River Thames. Across the water is a grand clock tower, all sandstone and gold. Big Ben sits high above the ornate Houses of Parliament and the Palace of Westminster. On this side of the water, though, by a busy road, is a much older building, red brick and white stone, stained dark in places by the city's grime. This is Lambeth Palace, home to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he's agreed to speak to us today. Now, while I try to get across this road, let me tell you what else we have for you this week. Lots still to come, including a report from South Africa on the man with a plan to build houses out of rubbish.
You can see the stone was reclaimed from the excavations. There was an old building on the site, which was taken apart brick by brick, and all the components from that building reused in the new building.
Also today, how East European Greens helped rip aside the Iron Curtain.
The system change idea was, on a very great extent, a fight for nature.
And we'll hear from the woman who wants to paint my house with slime. Do stay with us. Well, here we are. There's a massive wooden gate here, and a little to the right, a much smaller one. Can't seem to find a bell. No. Here we go. Hello. Thank you. Now, the current Archbishop, Dr. Rowan Williams, has his home and his offices here in this 13th century palace. He's the symbolic head of the worldwide Anglican Christian Communion, some 77 million people. It's a beautiful place.
Good morning, sir.
Good
morning. Mike Williams, how are you?
Hello.
Thanks for agreeing to see us. Let me just put my bag down.
Well, I'm in the study of His Grace, the Lord Archbishop of Canterbury, the Most Reverend and Right Honourable, Dr. Rowan Williams. Thanks for seeing us. That's quite a mouthful.
It is rather a bit. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. I just wonder what you think God will think of our custodianship of creation.
Well, I used to be an academic, and I think God might say beta double minus or worse at the moment. It's not impressive.
Do you think it's a moral issue?
I think it's very clearly a moral issue. I think that if it's part of our essential humanity to show care for the creation, and as a Christian believer, I'd say to imitate God's care for creation, then of course the abuse of the environment is a moral question. Not quite the same thing, but on a continuum with the abuse of another human being.
So what then is the Christian thing to do?
The Christian thing is to ask about any development in society or economics. Is this actually going to cut away the branch we're sitting on, to cut away the world itself that nourishes and sustains us and that we're supposed to be responsible to and for? So I think that does put some tough questions against the idea that endless economic growth is possible where you've got a finite material world.
It seems to me that you're effectively saying that we're just too greedy. We eat too much, consume too much. Is that right?
I suppose in plain English, yes, that's about right. We here being, of course, those nations who account for some phenomenal majority percentage of the world's consumption, as opposed to the majority of the world's population who account for such a tiny slice of it.
You mentioned population. It's an important topic and something that crops up time and time again among our listeners who believe that there are just too many people on the planet, that 6.8 billion and growing rapidly is unsustainable. Do you agree?
An endlessly growing population is unsustainable. But there are two things, I think, that make this a complicated part of the picture. First is that it sometimes suits people to say, well, the real problem is overpopulation, not overconsumption. And that's, let's say, a questionable way of coming at it. It's an attempt to shift responsibility once again onto the poorest. Second thing is that most government-led attempts to control population, I'm thinking of China especially, don't look very impressive morally or in other ways socially, for example. So getting that right, getting ourselves to a stage where the voluntary limitation of population is a reality, it's going to take a lot of work, and it's especially going to take a lot of work in those poorer economies where, of course, large families are part of your insurance system.
Is that all, then? We just have to accept that by 2050 there'll be 9 billion people on the planet?
I hope that some of the message will get through before then, but as I say, I'm cautious about shortcuts here because the effect of it seems to be pretty destructive in some areas.
I'd like to ask you about the church and what it can do. We've touched on this subject, but are you doing enough?
Whether I'm actually doing enough, I don't know, but I can say a bit about what we have been doing as a church. And, for example, last year at the Lambeth Conference, one of the most powerful presentations was on the environmental question. We also made available at the conference a carbon offsetting program for those who wanted to take part. And the Church of England itself now has this Shrinking the Footprint website, which gives advice on how to, in your local church, how to monitor and reduce your energy output. So quite a bit going on.
You seem to be keener to encourage them along a path instead of being a bit more dictatorial. The church has a great authority. Why don't you use it?
I think it's pretty optimistic to say the church has dictatorial authority.
It's a great authority, but I'm suggesting you might like to be a bit dictatorial.
You have to try and find out what makes a difference. And what makes a difference, above all, I think, is giving people realistic options that they feel they can make a difference with. To raise morale in that way, to give people a sense that they can make a bit of a difference, I would say that's much more important than just either issuing detailed directives, which the more detailed they get, the more absurd they might sound, or vaguely threatening disaster.
The finances of the church. You are effectively the CEO of a very large and quite wealthy organization here. What are you doing to ensure that the church's wealth is being used to further these aims that you express?
We have an ethical investment advisory group for the Church Commission as our sort of fund holders, which monitors this, among other ethical questions. It's not perhaps as high up on the agenda as some of us would like it to be in the ethical priorities, but it's getting there. We have moved, I think, in pushing it further up.
A little, though. If you'll forgive me, I'm just looking at the 2008 annual report. You have £6.5 million in an investment trust focusing on green products, but you've got £6.7 million in PepsiCo, £103 million in Royal Dutch Shell, and £29 million in the world's largest mining company, BHP Billiton. Does that sound right to you?
I don't think that we change the investment pattern overnight. It's, as I say, come up the agenda in recent years. Some of us are pressing that it should be further up.
Just before I say goodbye and thank you very much, I'm in the awkward position of having to ask you, the leader of a massive Anglican worldwide community, for a confession. I wonder whether you have an environmental sin that you might be willing to share with us.
Difficult, because I don't always monitor my carbon emissions every night. And having recently had to go to Japan for an official visit to the church there, I'm rather aware of high level of consumption just in the last couple of weeks. But I think at the personal level, it would have to be putting things in the wrong box in the kitchen time and again when I'm trying to get the recycling right.
It can be a bit tricky. Your Grace, thank you very much. Dr. Rowan Williams, I'm grateful for your time. Well, it's time for us to leave this peaceful little haven through the great gates back into the noise and the speed of central London. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what the Archbishop had to say. You can email oneplanet@bbc.com or join the Facebook discussion. Search for One Planet BBC. I'm off home now. It'll take me about 45 minutes, but thanks to the modern miracle of radio, you'll be there in just a second or two. Well, this is where I live, a tiny terraced house in southwest London. After hearing from the Archbishop on matters of morality and faith, we're going to get down to something a little more palpable now. Something solid, like bricks and mortar. The building blocks of buildings, really. I'm expecting a visitor here very soon, someone who's going to tell me how to breathe some life into this place. Before she arrives, though, let's run quickly through some other stories that have caught our eye this week. Researchers in the United States say the demand for oil in developed economies may have peaked. Number crunchers at Cambridge Energy Research Associates put this down to greater fuel efficiency in the transport sector, the wider use of renewable energy, and an aging population which spends less time behind the wheel. But there's a catch, of course. Demand for oil in developing countries, particularly in China, is growing and growing fast. Now, you may remember the giant dust storms that enveloped Australia recently. Well, scientists at the University of Sydney say the dust may have had a beneficial effect. The dust that landed in the Tasman Sea was carrying topsoil rich in nutrients, and they say that's caused a massive growth of phytoplankton. That's good news, apparently, because it traps carbon dioxide and helps to feed the fish. And we couldn't resist news of the discovery of the world's first vegetarian spider. The script actually says predominantly vegetarian, but you wouldn't want the facts to get in the way of a good story. The arachnid is called Bagheera kiplingi, and it lives in acacia trees in Mexico and Costa Rica. It steals food from ants by mimicking their movements and their chemical scent. Here's one of the researchers, Christopher Meehan.
Well, it's one very bright point on the map of the diversity of life, and it's the impossible, so to speak, possible. Bagheera comes from a race of visually oriented, clever hunters, and it uses its vision and high cognitive capacity now to hunt plants instead of ants.
I guess that, like me, those plants are slow-moving and easy to catch. That was Christopher Meehan. Perfect timing. Just let me go and get the door.
Dr. Armstrong, hiya. Come on in.
You've got quite a gathering on your doorstep already.
What's that for? I think they're just doing some building work next door. Please come on in. I'm afraid it's a little cramped today. We've got Simon here and lots of cables and computers and papers. Come on in, take
Hi,
a seat.
Simon.
Rachel Armstrong, I'm just going to go put the kettle on. Why don't you introduce yourself for us?
Okay. Hello, I'm Rachel Armstrong. I am a TED Global Fellow and my research is in living buildings, essentially. It's about reimagining what we can do with the exteriors of our architectures and the homes that we live in.
I said a little earlier that you want to breathe some life into the buildings we live in. Welcome to my home. What could you do with it?
My particular interest is on the exterior of buildings because of the obvious issue of climate change. And what we'd like to do is to create coatings and paints for the surfaces of buildings. So, for example, with this terraced house here, we could imagine a solution that we could apply to the surface that will allow it to gradually absorb carbon dioxide and turn it into a kind of limestone in the way that you'd come home and it would look like it's Christmas and it's been snowing and that there's a fine frosting over the surface of your building.
And what's the paint? What do you put on it to do this?
Well, the paint is like a solution that's got tiny little globules of fat in it. And these globules of fat are the smart elements, and they're able to take carbon dioxide and turn it into a crystal form, which we'd call a carbonate. And that's essentially a kind of limestone.
And it traps CO2 from the atmosphere, turns it into a solid form, so it's not causing any bother up there anymore.
Absolutely. It actually does it in a number of ways. So it can turn the carbon dioxide into a crystal. Once those crystals are formed, it encourages other crystals to join the carbon dioxide fixation. And then if you apply series of solutions, you get trapping of the carbon dioxide between the layers.
So my house, and if we look out the window, we'll see all the little houses here. Everybody's got their own little paint scheme and their own little, you know, their pastel colours all the way down the road. We're all going to end up living in little crusty white houses that look like they've been snowed upon.
That's one potential scenario, and I think it's one that's endorsed by Stephen Chu and Art Rosenfeld.
Stephen Chu, I know. We've interviewed him on the programme. He's the US Energy Secretary, a Nobel Prize winner. I don't know Art Rosenfeld.
Art Rosenfeld is from the California Energy Commission, and he was working with Stephen Chu. And essentially what they said was that if you painted the reflective surfaces of the 10 largest cities in the world white, you would save 44 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide emissions, because essentially all the heat energy would be reflected off the roofs and people wouldn't be turning on their cooling systems.
One worry I've got is, how do you stop this process? I mean, this is a very, very narrow road. If my house is getting wider and wider and their house is getting wider and wider, we're going to struggle to reach our front doors eventually, aren't we?
That's a very good question. I mean, essentially, these agents don't have any genes. So first of all, they're not going to run away and take over the Earth because they're not actually alive.
Reassuring.
And secondly, you know, if we starve them of energy or we starve them of resources, they stop working. And you know, it actually does raise some ethical questions, because if they're not quite alive but they are a little bit living, I mean, is that something that we should be doing?
We'll come on to those tricky questions about the responsibilities that we have to our paint in just a moment. I'd like you to listen to this with us first, if you would, Dr. Armstrong. Here on One Planet, we're fortunate enough to have a lot of loyal listeners with a lot of ideas, and thankfully, also, they're willing to share them. Brian Bickers just won. He emailed oneplanet@bbc.com to tell us about the work of a South African architect, a man called Vernon Collis. And Mr. Collis has this intriguing plan to make buildings out of material that's destined for the dump. The BBC's man in Cape Town is Mohammed Ali, and he went to meet him.
Hello? Good morning, Vernon.
Yes, come in.
Okay, thank you. I've come to one of the loveliest parts of Cape Town, Devil's Peak, which lies at the foot of the city's world-famous Table Mountain. Now I've come to meet with Vernon Collis, an architect and engineer who's constructing buildings in a totally different and environmentally friendly way. Now Vernon, how are the buildings that you design and construct different from the normal brick and mortar buildings that most people around the world are used to?
Well, most buildings are designed in a design office, and then the building's designed first and the materials obtained afterwards. This process reverses it in the sense that you develop a palette of materials first and understand the site of what you can salvage from there.
There's a little precinct here that you've developed and come up with your concept, and we can see the manifestation thereof here.
You can see the stone was reclaimed from the excavations, and the timber pallets were cleaned and used to make the doors and the eaves and all the bricks on this old building. There was an old building on the site, which was taken apart brick by brick, and all the components from that building reused in the new building. The convention would be to cart all this to landfill and then get all new building material in from another quarry. But if you recycle on site, it takes two lines of transport out of the equation, and that significantly reduces the carbon footprint. I've taken measurements, and we've reduced the footprint by up to 500%.
Well, it's all good and well putting into practice these wonderful ideas in an upmarket area like Devil's Peak, where residents can afford to build their own homes. But what about poorer South Africans, who are said to number more than half of the country's 48 million population? Will they be able to benefit? Now let's go to the township of Mbekweni, which is about 70 kilometers northeast of Cape Town, where Collis has put some of his ideas into practice. Vernon, first of all, how did you get out to Mbekweni?
The government came and saw my work in the city. They knew that their site out in Mbekweni had a lot of waste around it and a lot of rocks, and they asked if I could demonstrate a house.
And the materials, are they easily accessible? You mentioned there were materials around, but are they generally accessible in Mbekweni?
The location of Mbekweni is on the site itself. It's on a floodplain. And the floodplain means that there's good building material below in the form of cobbles and sand. There was a municipal building dump site 500 meters from the site, where there were bricks and rubble that could be recycled and reused. And this house has got, the floors were made from slate and granite.
And I see it's a double-story semi-detached dwelling as well.
The overall concept of this was to demonstrate that by using waste, and you could make a bigger house than the conventional 36 square meter low-cost house.
And I see you've got rainwater tanks as well, so there's water conservation being applied?
Rainwater tanks and solar geysers. This house was built within the government budget. By using waste, gave us extra money to use in order to build in solar geysers and rainwater tanks.
With South Africa's poor facing a massive housing backlog of about 2.5 million units, the unemployment rate said to be as high as 30%, and natural resources dwindling at an alarming rate, Vernon Collis's idea of using landfill and waste products in a labor-intensive construction process looks like it could kill a few birds with just one recycled stone.
That was Mohammed Ali reporting. You can see lots of pictures of those buildings on our Facebook page. And thanks for all the comments we've already had. Jackie in Pennsylvania, USA, says she loves them. Michael in Barbados says they're simply beautiful. I'd like to know what you think. Just search for One Planet BBC. You should find us easily. Well, with me here is Dr. Rachel Armstrong. Dr. Armstrong,
The way that Vernon Collis was talking about building there seems to me to be a very old way of building. You find what's available and use that to make what you can. That seems like a sensible path, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I'm absolutely for finding more efficient ways to use local resources, which is why, you know, thinking about the way that we build buildings and, you know, deconstructing them and reconstructing them is incredibly important. But I don't think it's the whole story. I think that we have to also find new ways of thinking about what sustainable building practice actually means.
Are we going to be able to afford it?
These protocells and these early steps of looking at carbon capture are really, really cheap and simple to make. In fact, they're so cheap and simple to make that when we get the right recipe, I personally would like to give them away. Essentially, it's oils, soap and some minerals, and that's it. It's like cooking.
Dr. Armstrong, why don't you help yourself to some tea and biscuits while we press on? Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Now, before we go much further, a quick message to the St. Joseph School in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Thanks for the email. Good luck with the project, and I'm sure that we can help. I'll be in touch. Now, the politics of the environment has become, to some extent at least, mainstream these days. It wasn't always so. 20 years ago, in Eastern Europe, people took to the streets, and communist regimes there, which had looked unmovable for 40 years, wavered and fell. But what motivated the marches? There were clearly many provocations. But in Hungary, a plan to build a massive hydroelectric dam on the River Danube was one of the triggers for those rare, brave protests against authority. Nick Thorpe reports.
A weekday afternoon on the shore of the Great Green Danube, just at the point where the river turns south after flowing from west to east for so long. There's an occasional fish jumping. It's one of the most beautiful spots in Hungary, overlooked by the mountains on both sides and the medieval castle of Visegrad. This is where the dam was never built.
We have this great river, and it's an artery flowing through the country.
Gabor Karacony is a writer and painter who got involved early on in the campaign to prevent the damming of the Danube at Nagymaros.
It's not only the physical greatness of this river, but its energy, and not the energy about which engineers are thinking that we can use it for electricity or so, but more like a vitalizing energy which goes through the whole region.
The Gabčíkovo-Nagymaros project was signed between Hungary and Czechoslovakia in 1977. It envisaged the diversion of the Danube and one power station inside Slovakia and another 100 kilometres downstream in Hungary. Building was already well advanced in both countries when a handful of people began to protest. They called themselves the Danube Circle. Gabor Karacony again.
For me it was a liberating idea that we can do something. And I think it's a good characteristic of Hungary and of Hungarians that the system change idea was, on a very great extent, a fight for nature. It's a difference, I think, from some other countries. Here it was like a struggle for life.
In September 1988, the Danube Circle brought several thousand people onto the streets of Budapest for what was then an illegal march. Ever larger demonstrations followed, and in May 1989, Hungary's last communist government suspended the project. The mood of unrest, which the protest helped unleash, then swept away the remnants of the one-party state. Adrian Hajosi was one of the marchers.
This was a huge achievement for an environmental movement. I know of few protest movements on a global scale which managed to stop such an advanced, such an expensive project on environmental grounds.
But the Danube Circle was only half successful. I'm walking through the lower Szigetkőz region, 80 kilometres upstream from Nagymaros. Dry grass and weeds grow everywhere. When Hungary pulled out of the project, Slovakia went ahead on their own and diverted the river into their own turbines at Gabčíkovo, and a unique wetland region similar to the delta of the Danube dried out. Csaba Horvat has been fishing here for 20 years.
Régen keszegett ezen a részen, There used to be huge numbers of bream here. I'd always catch them, good ones as well. But today, I've been here since 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's 2 now, and nothing.
But only a few kilometres upriver, there is water. The same Hungarian civil engineers who once lobbied unsuccessfully to complete the hydroelectric system were given a new task, to save the Szigetkőz region. They established a complex system of weirs and dikes to divert some of the remaining water from the main riverbed into the side branches. In the upper Szigetkőz region, they've succeeded. Emil Janak is head of the Northern Danubian Water Authority.
Every minute we are able to take the water into the branches, because every day the aquatic habitat get waters.
The engineers are now working on a plan to bring water back to the lower Szigetkőz region as well. 20 years after the political changes, Hungary is still trying to persuade Slovakia to increase the amount of water in the old bed. But downstream, here at Nagymaros, the Danube flows unimpeded. The environmentalist victory is still intact.
Nick Thorpe was our reporter there. I'm grateful to him and to you for tuning in. The music seems very appropriate given our earlier conversation with the Archbishop of Canterbury. Dr. Williams was kind enough to share his environmental confession. Now it's my turn. This week we're responsible for generating 301 kilograms of carbon dioxide, a total for the series to date of 11.9 tons of the stuff. Not pretty, perhaps, but it is true. I hope it's instructive too. That's all we have time for now. Next week, we'll be in Kenya, in the capital, and in the Mau Forest to the west. It would be great if you could join me in Nairobi or in Kericho. If you'd like to come along for a chat, email oneplanet@bbc.com for the details. Thanks for your time. I hope you'll join me again next week. Goodbye.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.